Wayfair's big sale is returning. Get ready for Way Day. For 4 days only, score up to 80% off all things home with free shipping on everything. From October 26th through 29th, score Wayfair's best deals, like up to 80% off area rugs, up to 60% off mattresses, up to 60% off bedroom furniture, and more exclusive doorbuster deals. So mark your calendar and shop Way Day starting October 26th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is simple. We take a stack of sources, articles, and biographical research, and we cut right to the core.
Yeah, giving you the essential, maybe the most surprising insights.
Exactly. And today, we are profiling one of the, well, great multi-hyphenates of British comedy. An artist who spent, what, 2 decades sort of everywhere at once?
That's a good way to put it.
You know, from the most prestigious, high-concept, award-winning fringe stuff, performance art even,
right,
all the way to, well, this stable, almost kind of bland presence in one of TV's biggest franchises.
We are talking about Timothy Key, born in 1976. And this comprehensive biographical overview we've got really reveals an artist defined by his own contradictions, you could say.
Yeah.
He's, like you said, a poet, comedian, an actor, a screenwriter, even a consultant.
Right.
So the goal of this deep dive is really to understand the scope of his work. Specifically, charting how he manages a career that successfully blends this, like, literary rigor, sometimes bordering on the absurd, with genuinely pervasive mainstream commercial success.
And that contradiction, that's really the hook for this, isn't it? Because
yeah.
If you ask the average viewer, say, in the UK, or even globally,
yeah,
they'd immediately place him as sidekick Simon Denton from the Alan Partridge universe.
Definitely.
You know, the perpetually loyal, slightly awkward supporting guy.
That's his global calling card, for sure. But what's crucial for you to understand, I think, is that the same artist, only a few years into his active career,
yeah,
won the 2009 Edinburgh Comedy Award for Best Comedy Show.
Which is huge.
It's arguably the biggest prize in world comedy. And he won it for a solo show called The Slutcracker.
Which was a poetry show. That's the key thing. Not stand-up, not sketch.
No. Performance poetry.
And that specific achievement, it just establishes his career template right away, doesn't it? Highly literary, deeply funny, intentionally sort of niche, yet critically acclaimed to the highest degree. So let's start by looking at where this unique kind of nonlinear approach actually began.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Starting with his educational foundation, because it immediately signals, well, a divergence from the typical path you'd expect for a performer. Key grew up in Impington, Cambridgeshire.
Right.
Attended local colleges. But his university choice and his degree, definitely unexpected.
Mm.
He went to the University of Sheffield.
And he got a Bachelor of Arts degree in Russian.
Russian.
Yeah. And look, this isn't just a quirky detail. It's actually highly significant, I'd argue.
Mm.
When we talk about the most famous comedians or writers coming out of the British university system.
Yeah, Oxford usually, maybe English lit. History.
Exactly. They typically studied English literature, history, or perhaps something performance adjacent.
Right. So studying Russian, I mean, a language steeped in this huge literary tradition, complex linguistic structures. And when you think about the comedic potential in Russian literature itself.
No, absolutely. From Chekhov's sort of existential angst to the societal absurdism of like Gogol or Bulgakov. How does that, do you think, inform his later work? Does that explain some of the specific intellectual rigor we see in his comedy?
I think it absolutely does, or at least it points towards it. It speaks to a mind that's naturally drawn to structure and linguistic play, yeah, but also to non sequitur and absurdity. His poetry isn't just random. It often uses these formal constraints, the appearance of meter, rhythm, rhyme, and then it completely subverts them.
How so?
With incredibly mundane, modern, or sometimes, you know, slightly shocking content, you need a certain kind of literary ear to pull off deliberately bad poetry successfully.
All right. It's harder than it looks.
Exactly. It's a very specific art form.
Yeah.
And that Russian BA suggests an early engagement with complex literary concepts, a way of thinking about language.
So it kind of sets the stage for this non-linear career path. He wasn't aiming for a conventional route, clearly. You get a Russian BA, and then what do you do next?
Well, you pivot, but maybe not break entirely from the expected. You return to Cambridge.
Okay.
To join the famed Cambridge Footlights.
Oh.
But here's a really critical detail. He did this despite not being a current Cambridge University student.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which speaks volumes about his early determination, I think.
That's fascinating because the Footlights, it's this legendary launch pad for, well, practically every major name in British comedy.
Yeah, historically.
But it's historically a student-run thing. Yeah. So for him to actively seek out and join that group after graduating, it shows he knew where the creative energy was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was determined to be part of that crucible of talent.
And the results were pretty much immediate. His first Footlights appearance was in 2001 in a stage production called Far Too Happy.
Right.
And that show went straight up to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe.
Wow.
And got nominated for the Edinburgh Comedy Award for Best Newcomer.
Straight out of the gate.
Almost instantaneous. Jump onto the radar of critics, producers, you name it. He established his trajectory right from the start. High visibility, high critical acclaim.
And it was during this period, wasn't it, that he forged that collaborative foundation, the thing that defines so much of his long-term success, specifically with the sketch group Cowards.
Cowards. Yes, crucial. Because it's like a snapshot of the generation of talent emerging alongside him. He formed the group with Tom Basden.
Who's everywhere now.
Exactly. Stefan Golizewski.
Mom, him and her. Amazing writer.
And Lloyd Wolf. Each of those names has gone on to massive individual success. Basden is a sitcom writer, actor.
Mm.
Golizewski creating highly acclaimed BBC drama, comedy. Wolf's acting career.
So Key was operating in this intensely collaborative, really ambitious environment right from the beginning. What was the style of Cowards generally?
Their style was distinctively smart, often quite surreal, and maybe slightly melancholic, which is kind of a hallmark of that early 2000s Footlights output, I think.
Mm.
And they moved pretty quickly from the stage into television. They got their own TV series, which aired in 2009. And this demonstrated Key's ability to work as part of a, you know, tightly structured, successful writing team. It really laid the groundwork for his later collaborations. Coogan, obviously, but also Horne, Watson.
Right.
He learned how to structure narrative, how to maximize comedic impact within a group, which is a totally different skill set than, say, solo performance poetry.
It seems like that 2009 period was massive for him then. The Cowards TV show airs, and then he just explodes solo. Let's move to section two and talk about how he really conquered the stage, but completely on his own terms.
Yeah, if Cowards was the proving ground for collaboration, that 2009 Edinburgh triumph with the Slutcracker was his, I don't know, declaration of independence, a singular artistic voice. You really can't overstate the shockwaves this sent through the comedy world at the time.
You mentioned it won the top prize, the Edinburgh Comedy Award for Best Comedy Show. For anyone listening who might not know the awards history that well, why is winning it with a poetry show? Why was that such a revolutionary act?
Well, because the award, pretty much since it started, has overwhelmingly recognized stand-up comedy.
That's right. Or maybe high-energy sketch, character comedy. It rewards polished, joke-heavy routines, generally speaking.
And the Slutcracker wasn't that.
Not at all. It was intimate, highly conceptual. It relied heavily on Key's very deadpan delivery of these poems.
Yeah.
Which were this kind of self-aware doggerel, often mixing the profound with the completely pedestrian, and then punctuated by him doing things like, you know, throwing cashews at the audience or using absurd props.
Right, the visual element.
It forced the entire critical establishment, really, to redefine what a comedy show could even mean.
And the fact that he was also nominated for the Malcolm Hardy Award for Comic Originality in the same year.
Yeah.
That just reinforces the point, doesn't it?
Totally.
This wasn't just a successful show, it was an innovative concept. Critics immediately saw it as boundary pushing.
Exactly. It had intellectual heft, real originality. Mm. And Key understood the commercial value of that critical success. He leveraged it straight away.
How so?
Took the Slutcracker to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival the very next year.
This is how he established his distinctive performance brand globally.
Yeah.
Literary, sort of lo-fi aesthetic, but incredibly sharp underneath.
It speaks to the confidence he must have gained from that success, that he simultaneously started looking for more demanding, maybe more traditional acting roles.
Yeah.
That high concept fringe success suddenly opened doors to serious theater work.
It really did. The move into theatrical versatility, it just demonstrates his extraordinary range beyond his particular brand of poetry. He co-starred in Daniel Kitson's critically acclaimed play, Tree.
Oh, wow. Kitson's another unique voice.
Exactly. It premiered in Manchester in 2013, then transferred to the venerable Old Vic in London in 2015. And collaborating with Kitson, another boundary-pushing artist, showed Key's commitment to sophisticated, non-conventional dramatic work, too.
And then, not long after, he was in some serious high-end drama Yasmina Reza's massive play art.
Right, at the Old Vic again.
Alongside acting heavyweights like Paul Ritter, God rest his soul, and Rufus Sewell, that ran late 2016 into early 2017. How does an artist sustain two such vastly different aesthetics? You know, the conceptual, self-aware poet on one hand,
yeah,
and the highly disciplined classical theater actor on the other. Without confusing his audience, I suppose.
Well, I think the connection might lie in his mastery of tone and constraint.
Okay.
In his poetry, the constraint is the structure of the verse itself, which he then deliberately subverts.
Right.
In traditional drama like art, the constraint is the text, the blocking. And his comedic ability, that timing, allows him to find the sud of truth and humor within those rigid boundaries. His stage training, whether doing his own stuff or someone else's, seems constant.
But despite these forays into established drama, he never actually abandoned his signature aesthetic, did he? His later stage work, like Megadate, that toured 2017 to 2018, leaned right back into his core, familiar performance format.
Oh, absolutely. It felt like a conscious return to form. Like The Slutcracker. Megadate followed the pattern, Key reading his self-aware doggerel, interspersed with those idiosyncratic, really distinctive black and white films he makes. It's his comfort zone, maybe, but it's also a highly consistent, recognizable format. It ensures his audience knows exactly what they're getting.
Which is
intimate, funny, slightly chaotic literary performance.
And we see that consistency evolve again with his most recent major stage success, Mulberry, which really highlights his ability to turn shared global experience into compelling sellout art.
Yes. The 2023 Mulberry Tour. It's centered thematically on Key's highly relatable experience during the COVID-19 lockdowns in Britain.
Yeah, we all went through that.
Exactly. And it showcased how immediately and effectively he can respond to the contemporary moment.
And the response was incredible, wasn't it? A sellout tour across the UK and Ireland. But that success went beyond national borders. The real indicator of his expanding international appeal, maybe, is that he took the show based on a uniquely British experience of lockdown. Yeah.
To the Soho Playhouse in New York City.
Wow. That's real proof that his hyper-specific, highly literary voice can have universal resonance, provided the humor is grounded in a shared human experience, like, you know, existential dread or extreme domesticity.
Right.
His stage career is just a perfect example, really. Starting small, winning big, and then using that credibility to sustain both commercial acting roles and this very niche, self-penned performance art.
Okay, so moving from that intimate, sometimes chaotic world of performance poetry, we absolutely have to address the character that probably cemented his place in the mainstream consciousness more than anything else, sidekick Simon Denton.
Ah, yes, Simon. This role provides that stable, recurring anchor in his career, doesn't it? It's a testament to his ability to play a really subtly comedic foil.
Where did it start?
The character debuted in the online series Mid-Morning Matters with Alan Partridge, way back in November 2010.
That timing is crucial, isn't it? Mid-Morning Matters showed Steve Coogan's team were really aware of changing media consumption.
Starting the series online, it was later broadcast on Sky Atlantic, in 2012 pushed Key's face and his very distinct, restrained comedic timing out to a massive, immediate audience.
And the character of Simon Denton is just a perfect comedic construct, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's the bland, totally loyal presence that allows Partridge's monstrous ego to just bounce off him.
Yeah.
Key delivers a masterclass in subtle reaction. He's not overtly funny himself. His humor comes from his sincerity, his slightly painful, genuine adoration of Alan.
And once that relationship was established, it was pretty clear Key was a permanent fixture, wasn't he? He reprised the role in the 2013 film outing Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa.
Right.
That transition from a web series to a major feature film confirmed the character's popular appeal.
And the partnership just keeps evolving, spanning decades now.
Right.
The role of sidekick Simon was brought back for the successful BBC series, this time with Alan Partridge, which ran from 2019 to 2021.
So Key's been actively collaborating with Steve Coogan for, what, well over a decade?
Yeah, easily.
Utilizing streaming, film, television, all simultaneously. This continuous, high-profile foundation, it must grant him an immense amount of creative freedom, right? Allowing him to pursue those much riskier, maybe less profitable experimental stage and radio projects.
Oh, absolutely.
Knowing he has this recurring, successful anchor role.
Yeah, the safety net allows for the experimentation. And what's more, his relationship with Coogan actually goes back even further. He appeared in the satirical comedy Saxondale way back in 2007.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, showing an early established trust in Key's ability to deliver that very dry, understated comedy.
And he appeared with Coogan again later, didn't he, in the 2019 film Greed, playing the character Sam.
That's right. So this isn't a one-off casting. It's a deep, recurring creative relationship. Key is clearly valued as a reliable, subtle comedic actor within that tight, very influential Coogan ecosystem.
It's proof that sometimes the most successful collaborations are just the most consistent ones.
So, if the Partridge collaboration provides stability, Key's partnerships with Alex Horn and Mark Watson, well, they provide the fertile ground for genuine innovation, I think. Section 4 really shows Key is driven by this desire to invent entirely new comedic games.
Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Take Back Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeBack.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeBack.com.
Names and formats.
Okay, let's start with We Need Answers, co-created with Watson and Horn for BBC Four back in 2009. What was the core format of that show, and what did it say about their inventive streak?
It was brilliantly bizarre, actually. It was a comedic quiz show, right? But the conceit was totally unique.
Yeah.
Instead of answering questions based on their own knowledge, celebrity contestants had to answer questions posed by various online sort of question-answering tech services that were popular back then.
Oh, I remember those. Ask Jeeves kind of thing.
Sort of, yeah. It was commentary on the nascent technological age, really, wrapped up in a quiz show format.
Hmm.
Watson hosted. Horn handled the technical side, the apparatus.
And Key's role?
Key's role was reading the questions.
It's a perfect example of taking a very specific kind of niche technological reality and turning it into a comedic premise. But the true collaborative genius arrived outside the main show, didn't it? With the online stuff.
It really did.
Yeah.
The BBC uploaded bonus online content for We Need Answers, which were basically just videos of Key and Watson playing this highly specific parlor game they had apparently invented years earlier. No More Women.
Right. That's the genesis moment, isn't it, of what became this massive, sustained online hit. They were just playing this idiosyncratic card game narrated by Horn, seemingly just for fun.
And that game had this remarkable, almost viral trajectory, especially during the pandemic lockdowns. It really took off. They reunited in 2020 to play it as a trio, Key, Horn, and Watson, renaming it No More Jockeys.
Which became a true cult hit.
Absolutely.
For anyone listening who hasn't encountered it yet, what are the basic rules of No More Jockeys? And why did this simple, frankly, quite silly game resonate so profoundly during that period of global stasis?
Well, the rules are deceptively simple, yet somehow immensely complicated, which is the genius of it, I think.
Okay.
It's played with standard playing cards, right?
Yeah.
But each card represents a jockey, basically a person or a category of person that has to be eliminated from the game if that card is played.
Right.
But the joke is that every category is based on highly arbitrary, linguistic, sometimes completely pedantic definitions.
For example.
Like if you play a four, you might declare no more jockeys who have ever worn a hat, or maybe no more jockeys whose name contains the letter S.
Okay.
And then Key, Horn, and Watson spend minutes, sometimes hours, arguing over the precise pedantic definition of the elimination criteria. It's hilarious.
So it's comedy based on collaborative, competitive pedantry.
Precisely. And it resonated during lockdown, I think, because it provided this perfect escape, a consistent, low-stakes environment where three highly intelligent, witty people were taking something utterly nonsensical with extreme seriousness.
Yeah.
It was intellectual structure applied to total absurdity. And Key's contribution, often fueled by this mischievous desire to just derail the pedantry, is essential to the friction and the flow.
Mm.
It really demonstrates how he and his inner circle can take an offhand idea and turn it into a sustained cultural phenomenon, based purely on their collective chemistry and dedication to the format.
It's the ultimate example, maybe, of a fringe creation becoming a cult hit just through persistence. We also need to highlight Key's long and, well, fruitful radio career on BBC Radio 4, which is often tied back to his partnership with Tom Baston.
Yeah, that radio collaboration is foundational and shows incredible longevity. It began way back in 2006 with the commissioning of All Bar Luke,
which was based on
their earlier stage show, Luke and Stella. Key was also heard in the radio sitcom Party in 2010 which was also created by Baston. They clearly have a shared comedic language.
But the truly unique format, the one that defines their long-running success on radio, has to be Tim Key's late-night poetry program.
Oh, definitely.
Started in 2012, and it's already run for 6 series as of 2024.
And here we see his signature stage aesthetic, the self-aware poetry, translated perfectly for the airwaves. It's not just a poetry reading, though.
No.
It's an interactive show. Key reads his verse, and Baston provides musical accompaniment and, crucially, these conversational interjections.
Ah, okay.
Baston acts as the grounding element. Sometimes he's slightly bewildered, sometimes gently mocking the poetry. It gives the show a dynamic rather than just being a straight recitation.
Before we move on to his screen portfolio, we absolutely must indulge in one of the most wonderfully quirky footnotes of his early career. It just provides such great texture, doesn't it? His willingness to jump into almost any project.
I know exactly where you're going with this. His appearance in 2002, right at the start of his active period.
Yeah.
In the first series of Britain's Worst Driver.
Yes. He was billed as Timid Tim. It's such a fantastic contrast to the award-winning poet and the subtle screen actor we know now. What do we actually know about his time on this, well, reality show?
Well, the whole point of the show was finding and reforming terrible drivers.
Right.
Right? He was eliminated second.
So bad, but not the worst.
Apparently quite bad, but not catastrophically so. The prize he received, even though he was eliminated, was a brand new car.
Right.
And what did the budding intellectual comedy star do with his prize?
I have a feeling I know.
He promptly sold it after only a week.
That is the perfect Tim Key detail, isn't it? Accepting a deeply commercial, maybe slightly embarrassing reality TV role, but immediately subverting the prize. Selling the car rather than adopting the lifestyle it represents. It's just a surprising little nugget that shows how long he's been navigating these different, often quite conflicting media landscapes. Okay, Section 5 takes us into his really impressive screen portfolio, highlighting that his influence is, well, both front and center as an actor, but also quietly working away behind the scenes. Let's start with short films, because they often seem to serve as the creative blueprint for his larger ambitions.
Yeah, the early collaborations with Tom Baston are vital here again. Their short film, the one and only Herb McGuire Plays Wallace Island from 2007, was an instant critical success.
How so?
It won Best UK Short at the Edinburgh Film Festival. And critically, it secured a BAFTA nomination in 2008.
Wow, a BAFTA nom for a short.
That's a massive early professional validation of their writing partnership.
And here is the incredible long-term payoff, isn't it? That short film became the creative foundation for the 2025 feature-length film, The Ballad of Wallace Island.
That's right.
And Key is also credited as a co-writer on the feature. It just demonstrates the longevity and the intrinsic quality of his original ideas. Ideas he's been nurturing and developing for, what, almost 2 decades?
And he also secured significant BFI Shorts production funding for another project, the black comedy short Anthony in 2014. He played Santa Claus in that one.
Right.
So short form, highly conceptual projects, often created with Baston, are clearly a core part of his creative metabolism.
Now, let's talk about the television role that perhaps best exemplifies his dual influence, Taskmaster. Most people probably remember him as a panelist on Series 1.
Yeah, he was brilliant on that.
Chaotic, endearing, often brilliant at approaching tasks completely laterally.
Key was a real breakout performer in that first series, definitely. But the deeper influence is revealed in his subsequent role since Series 2.
Yeah.
He has been credited as a task consultant.
A task consultant.
This transition, moving from being the subject of comedy to being a key creative force actually shaping the tasks themselves, that's incredibly rare.
What specifically is the unique value he brings as a task consultant? He's not just providing practical advice, surely. It has to be related to that same lateral thinking that drives his poetry.
Oh, absolutely. The show requires tasks that are simple in premise, but actively encourage lateral, often unnecessarily complicated thinking. Key's mind, which specializes in combining the mundane with the absurd, you know, writing a poem about a lost sock, but in heroic couplets, is perfectly suited to engineering those scenarios. He provides that intellectual curveball.
Can you give an example?
Well, he might conceptualize a task where contestants are forced to write a poem about a celebrity, say, but they can only use words found on a takeaway menu.
Ah, okay.
It's that blend of constraint and arbitrary self-seriousness that Key really champions.
It's a key example, no pun intended, of his behind-the-scenes influence. Using his poetic and comedic structural expertise to enhance a massive global format. Then there's his acclaimed dramatic performance in the anthology series Inside Number 9.
Ah, yes. He played Ian in the incredibly tense, claustrophobic 2014 episode Sardines.
Which is brilliant.
His performance in that really limited, intense setting earned him high critical praise. It was one journalist specifically who called him an unsung hero of British comedy.
That title just encapsulates his career perfectly, doesn't it? Mm. He is critically lauded, consistently excellent in whatever medium he chooses, but often operating just slightly outside the full glare of the A-list spotlight, preferring creative complexity over simple visibility, perhaps.
It says that way.
And it's a role he clearly values as he returned to the show, appearing as himself in the final episode in 2024, Plodding On.
And while he excels in these defining supporting and consulting roles, he has also carried major leads. He starred as Gideon Bannister, a 17th century witch hunter.
Right.
In the 2022 BBC Two comedy series, The Witchfinder. That's a significant, challenging historical lead role.
And we must, again, tie back to his collaborations. He took on the role of Ray the Nemesis, an old archery teammate.
That's right.
In Tom Basden's excellent BBC sitcom, Here We Go, in 2022, he truly is constantly cycling through these diverse roles, always working across different platforms with his small, talented, creative circle.
And looking at his feature film range outside the Partridge Films, he's consistently present in high-quality, often ensemble projects. The Double in 2013.
Mm.
The star-studded murder mystery. See how they run in 2022, playing Commissioner Harold Scott.
Yeah, he was great in that.
And the historical comedy Wicked Little Letters in 2023, where he played Father Ambrose. He's just a reliable character actor who brings instant gravity and comedic timing.
But his career trajectory now seems to be pointing, well, internationally. His upward cinematic movement continues with his casting as Pigeon Man.
Pigeon Man.
In the massive 2025 sci-fi film Mickey 17, which speaks to his rising profile in global cinema, surely.
However, the most significant indicator of his international momentum might be his major upcoming role as Ken Davies in Peacock's The Paper in 2025.
Right, The Paper.
This is described as a follow-up and spin-off to the American version of The Office.
Wow.
This places Key in the main cast of a huge international network series, potentially reaching an entirely new, massive audience across the Atlantic.
That is a monumental shift, isn't it, from reading poetry interspersed with homemade black and white films?
Quite the journey.
It is easy to forget, though, given that incredible acting and collaboration portfolio, that at his heart, Key really identifies as a poet. We can't conclude without circling back to the literary output, because for a self-proclaimed poet, Key has produced a substantial body of work, much of which acts as an extension of his performance persona.
Absolutely. His bibliography lists 7 books, I believe, and all of them are rooted in his signature style. Even the titles themselves are conversational and self-referential.
Yeah.
Immediately setting a tone of witty, slightly mock-serious instruction. Early works include Instructions, Guidelines, Tutelage, Suggestions from 2009.
Great title.
And The Incomplete Tim Key in 2011.
And he also found a unique way to translate his stage performance to audio, didn't he? Releasing the album Tim Key with the String Quartet on a boat in 2010.
Ah, yes. That project, featuring his poetry backed by a string quartet and, of course,
Basden.
Interjections from Tom Basden, it perfectly captures the live theatrical aesthetic, but in audio form.
But the most culturally relevant body of his literary work, arguably, arose directly from the constraints of the pandemic.
Mm.
His first book from this period, He Used Thought as a Wife, an anthology of poems and conversations from inside, published in 2020. It beautifully chronicled his experience during the UK's first COVID-19 lockdown.
This just highlights how immediate and adaptive his art is, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He captured that shared global experience of suddenly being confined,
mm-hmm.
blending the genuinely poignant with the everyday absurdities.
Mm, yeah.
It's a masterful piece of chronicling the contemporary moment, really.
And this literary project, it generated the energy for his subsequent work, didn't it? It led to the sequel, Here We Go, Round the Mulberry Bush, an anthology of poems and conversations from outside in 2022.
Right.
And as we discussed earlier, this book then directly informed the content and the title of his stage show, Mulberry.
Which toured in 2023.
Exactly. It's a closed artistic loop. Personal experience becomes a book, which then powers a successful international stage show.
His recent writing is maintaining this quality and relevance, too. Chapters from 2024 was praised for its humor and its subversive focus on the contemporary world, cementing his reputation as a serious, relevant writer.
And he already has another book slated for 2025, L.A. Baby.
Busy man.
always working. Finally, though, we should add maybe a layer of personal depth to his public persona by referencing his 2023 appearance on the Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer.
Ah, yes. That was quite revealing.
This appearance, framed around a charitable cause, allowed him a moment of genuine vulnerability, didn't it?
It really did. He opened up about his personal experience of being diagnosed with a melanoma.
Mm.
And in a world where his professional identity is often defined by distance, that deadpan delivery, the creation of slightly ridiculous characters.
Yeah.
That moment of sincerity, I think it resonated deeply with the audience. It showcased the human being behind the sidekick and the self-aware poet. So to synthesize this entire quite sweeping career, the key takeaway, I suppose, is that Key's immense success is really defined by his absolute refusal to be categorized.
Mm-hmm.
He is a critically acclaimed, high-concept performance poet who seamlessly navigates the most mainstream commercial successes.
He's the artist who won the biggest comedy prize with intentionally niche material, yeah. And yet simultaneously serves as a key creative force, a task consultant, in a major global TV format.
Right.
And takes on serious, demanding, dramatic acting roles. He moves between the avant-garde, self-aware fringe, and the high production mainstream, often within the same calendar year. He is, without question, an essential, though maybe often understated, figure in British comedy over the past 2 decades.
His career path almost serves as a blueprint for creative longevity, proving that the experimentation of the fringe can absolutely feed the mainstream, provided that unique voice, that blend of linguistic playfulness and absurdity, remains consistent.
Hmm.
He took the intellectual rigor of his Russian degree, maybe, the collaborative spirit of cowards, and the lateral thinking of his poetry, and applied it effectively to film sets, radio, television consulting, everything.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over. We've seen his early short film, the one and only McGuire Plays Wallace Island, finally adapted into a feature film in 2025.
After all this time.
And at the same time, he is launching into major international territory with The Paper. Given that he's moving into these massive franchise-adjacent writing and acting roles, is his next great act primarily going to be as a screenwriter and international television star? Or
will he always find himself compelled to return to the stage with a new stack of self-aware doggerel and a slightly battered projector?
What do you think?